This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
I'd like to give you an introduction of learning about finance as a Muslim student. And I'd say it's divided into two things. The first thing is that interest is not allowed. And the second thing is that you have to give 2.5% in the form of a charity tax every year. And that's pretty much where it stopped. I was speaking to Dr. Benedict earlier on, and he mentioned that after he first wrote an article to do with Islam and capitalism, they asked him to do it again, because simply the literature just isn't there. And slowly, as you start to discover the realities of what Islam offers, it's a lot more than what we seem to think. You know, there is a whole financial dynamic, a whole financial world, actually. And we refer to both speakers. And as I was speaking as well to Mufti Abdurrahman ibn Yusuf earlier on, Islam is it's a very holistic religion. And it tackles finance a lot more than we seem to think. At the moment, I'm writing my dissertation on an economic analysis of principles in Islamic finance. And one thing I've come to realize is that there is a lot more. Without any further delays, Dr. Benedict Kohler completed his BA in history from the University of Yale before doing an MSc from City University and then a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Tübingen. Dr. Benedict.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, my talk is about capitalism and what Islam has to do with it. So that's about two different things, capitalism and about Islam. And I've been asked, first of all, to speak a bit about capitalism, because you don't want to have a talk about Islam and then finding out at the end, actually, we don't see the connection to capitalism. So let me start talking about capitalism. Capitalism in itself is a very big word, and we use it all the time in all sorts of connections and has all sorts of connotations. In fact, this is one of the problems I have with people talking about capitalism. Capitalism is used in so many connotations, you don't really know what it means anymore, because it seems to apply to variously anybody who's doing business, anybody who invests, any market, long-distance trade, big corporations, and I could probably think of a couple of other things. The term capitalism now covers so much that it seems to be coming to overlap with the term economics generally. And I have a hard time figuring out, well, if capitalism envelops everything in economics, it's really a meaningless term and we don't need it anymore. There's got to be a bit about capitalism that makes capitalism different from economics when it's not capitalist. So there are four people, in my opinion, who told us about capitalism and what does make it different from economics generally. And I would like to touch on those one by one. They're Adam Smith, Karl Marx, Max Weber, and Friedrich von Hayek. Now, it's one of the problems when people speak about capitalism and say that it existed always, is that the first person that we associate with as being an economist of capitalism is Adam Smith, who wrote in the 18th century. So that's about 250 years ago. Until then, it seems nobody knew about capitalism, but it would have existed. But finally, in 1776, there's Adam Smith. He writes The Wealth of Nations, and now we have capitalism. And what are one of his key insights? There were many others, but one of those is that he said, well, the markets are guided by an invisible hand, by which he meant that you don't have a government saying what prices should be, you don't have any authority saying who should produce what, you don't have an overall plan for the economy, you have what he called the invisible hand. And the invisible hand is the multitude of individuals, all of us here, with our wants and needs and our supplies, who meet up and the market sorts it all out, and that's how production tends to those and gravitates to those services and products which people want most. That's the invisible hand. But Adam Smith, if you look for the word capitalism in Adam Smith, you won't find it. He never used it once. So let's move on to the second big important person, Karl Marx. Karl Marx, everybody tends to associate with his biggest book, which is about Kapital. So he wrote about capital. He had that notion that in a capitalist society, or in any society, there is a concentration of capital, and that capital is used and those people who have that capital exploit people who do not have any capital. And really, so said Karl Marx, history is a sequence of struggles over capital. So that's what he said is capitalism. That's how we would see it now. His analysis is about capitalism. But if you read Karl Marx, you'll have a hard time finding the word capitalism, because he does use it maybe half a dozen times, but never in the way we use it now. It's incidental, and it appears in a couple of sentences. So he didn't really use capitalism. Now we get to the 20th century, and there you have the person who put the ism into capitalism. That was the founder of sociology, Max Weber. Now, what did Max Weber do, and what did Max Weber write that makes him so different from Adam Smith and from Karl Marx? What makes him different is that he said capitalism is a very particular way of organizing a society. It's a society where people who engage in investment and engage in commerce have a very high social status and become role models. And because they become role models, whatever they do tends to become formative for society. That's his sociological approach. Capitalism isn't just about how you do business and then you go home and do something else. He says capitalism is about how you do business, but when you go home, you are still living the way a capitalist does. So to understand capitalism, you have to understand the way of life, the mentality, the outlook. And then he went on and he said, well, where does that outlook come from? Well, what capitalists do, they're very rational people. They plan, they look ahead, they delay having fun right now in favor of doing some really hard work, but it helps them have more fun at some later point in the future. So it's an entirely sober lifestyle that looks to the future and looks to rewards by accumulating material goods. And that attitude didn't exist in history from the very beginning. It came about at a very particular moment. It came about with the rise of Protestantism, because Protestants have this attitude of being very sober and of having the attitude of going to bed early, and early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And once that attitude became formative for society, then you have the mindset that creates capitalism. That was a very convincing theory. So everybody thought, well, now it's an open and shut case. But somebody discovered a tripwire, because they said, Professor Weber, this makes a lot of sense, what you're describing about a capitalist society. We buy into all of that. But the thing is, everything you describe already existed in the Middle Ages in places like Venice and Genoa, because they were ruled by merchants and they did a lot of investing and they got rich that way, and that shaped their society. But in Venice and Genoa and in the Middle Ages, they didn't have any Protestants. So can you please explain that? From then on, the reputation of Max Weber started to nosedive, because people thought the first bit of his theory works, but it doesn't really match the empirics. I now get to the next person who took it to the next level, Friedrich von Hayek. Hayek was somebody who said, I agree with most of what my predecessor economists have said, but there is something about a society that's capitalist that makes it different from any other society. But what makes it really different is that it has its essence, or its center, its core, in the market. So now a new approach, which has become dominant, came to the fore, which is to think of capitalist societies as market economies. And like Weber, he said, well, but a market economy is one where you not simply go to the market and buy and sell without anybody stopping you from doing that, but you also then go home, and because that's what you did during the day and it shaped your working life, it shapes the rest of your life. That has become a theory which became dominant because it was capable of explaining many, many social phenomena that you observe in capitalist societies. You associate a society that is based on markets with one that is very innovative, that is entrepreneurial, and that is progressive and open to new ideas. Hayek, for many decades, well, for several decades, was not at the forefront of economic debate, but he then rose to significant popularity when his views were taken on by the then Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher. So Hayekian economics and Thatcherism often is seen hand in hand. But his legacy is to say that there is such a thing as the market, there is such a thing as a government, but the two don't really get along very well. And a market squeezes out governments, and the government squeezes out markets, but there's a tension between markets and governments. So that's where I'm coming from when I talk about capitalism. I adopt the views of those key thinkers, in my view, Max Weber and Friedrich Hayek. Capitalism is a way of life. It's a way of approaching how society is structured, and it thinks of a capitalist society as one that has the market as its core social activity, and that core activity ripples outward to all other social phenomena. So much for capitalism. Now, what's Islam got to do with that? When you talk about capitalism, you tend to think about big cities, big companies, big department stores, luxuries, skyscrapers, and so on. Why do I claim capitalism began in Arabia, specifically with Islam? Well, the makings were already there before Islam came into being. They were already there during the Age of Ignorance, during Jahiliyyah. Why do I say that? Well, because Arabs at that time were unique in two particular respects. They didn't have a government, and they were worldwide traders. Arabs already, long before Muhammad was born, were trading in distant places as far away as China, and taking goods and transporting them to Europe. So right there, you have something in the Jahiliyyah which Hayek would have been very sympathetic to. It's not the absence of the government which he thought would be a problem. He would actually like that, because if there's no government to enforce the way people live, people have to find ways how to get along with each other on their own. And the second is, it was a society which lived off trading and taking goods from one part of the world to another. So they were very outward-looking, and they were accustomed to living in different legal frameworks. That made Arabs in the Jahiliyyah very different. So let's move on to a particular city in Arabia, to Mecca. Mecca was one of the cities in Arabia, in the Jahiliyyah, that was a center for devotion and for pilgrims. And when those pilgrims congregated and convened in Mecca, they had an opportunity to trade. So religion, so pilgrimage and trade developed side by side in Mecca long before Muhammad was born. It started to take off, especially around the mid-5th century, when a certain Qasai started to build a protective wall around the Kaaba and said, from now on, my tribe, Quraysh, we're going to manage this place. And it continued growing. And Qasai had many, many descendants, and they branched out into different families, and some of them were very distinguished commercial diplomats, one might say, in their own right. One of those was a man whose name is known because people generally refer to Hashemites as an important branch of Arab clans, and that was the man who gave the name to Hashemites, Hashim. Hashim was someone who did something that was then very new. Not only did he go and travel across deserts heading at the head of caravans, what he did was he was a commercial diplomat who wrote trade treaties with the heads of tribes through whose areas he traveled. It went something along the lines like this. He said, listen, guys, instead of you trying to ambush us, why don't we have an agreement here? You give us some of those goods that you would like to see sold in the Mediterranean. We'll take them to the Mediterranean, sell them, and when we get back, we'll split the profit. How does that sound? Saves you a lot of trouble and saves us a lot of headache, and it's a win-win situation. And these agreements were called the Ilaf. The Ilaf were very important because they did something, coincidentally, which the Haram in Mecca already did. They created a particular area that guaranteed personal property and pursuit of trade. So Hashim was another very important person to get after Qasai. By the time Muhammad was born, Mecca was already a thriving trade center, and caravans going from on the Ilafs from Mecca comprised as many as 2,500 camels. So these were pretty big businesses that were with division of responsibilities, which were already in train at the time Muhammad was born. Now, Muhammad was born a poor, an orphan. His father was a caravan trader, and he who had died while his mother Amina was expecting Muhammad. So he died. He died at a time when he did not yet have very much money, and Muhammad didn't have grew up a poor kid. But Muhammad had certain immaterial assets, because he was a direct descendant of Qusay and Hashim. So he came from a family that had, for several generations, been distinguished as caravan traders and as commercial diplomats. When he grew up, he started out as a shepherd, but he didn't stay a shepherd. His uncle Abu Talib arranged an introduction for him to find someone invest so that he too could be a caravan trader, which he did around the, in his early 20s. And in his mid-20s, he married the person who was his investor, Khadija. They were married for, I think, about 25 years. So Muhammad, who came from a commercial diplomatic family, who came from a family of caravan traders, married a caravan investor, and for a long, long time had day-by-day exposure to the mechanics of investing in caravans. Now, just for a moment, let's just look at these caravans. I already said they comprised, say, 2,500 camels. When you have 2,500 camels setting forth, there's a lot of organization that needs to go on. Somebody has to decide when they leave. You can't have a couple of camels leaving first, and a couple of the next day, and so on. If you want to organize it so that they're secure, you want them all to leave on the same date. For that to happen, everybody has to equip those camels by a certain date. For that to happen, production and supply has to be organized. So you have a vertical supply chain which has to be organized in that particular in the city. You also have something which is very important for the development of capitalism. Somebody needs to put up the money for this, because you have to pay salaries, you have to buy camels, and you have to make sure that those people who made money by selling can still wait for the caravan to return. What you need is somebody to underwrite the risk. So already in the days of Muhammad, you had what we would now call a capital market. You had some people who managed caravans, some people who were staffers on caravans, some people who supplied the goods that caravans would sell, and some people who invested in them. And one such investor was the wife of Muhammad, Khadija. When Muhammad then discovered his vocation and became a prophet, his first convert was his wife, Khadija. So in Islam, you have something that's very unusual for a religion. You have a religion where the prophet was an entrepreneur and where the first convert was a female venture capitalist. But that does not explain what Islam has got to do with capitalism. That could just be coincidental. What happens that the trigger, the tipping point for capitalism was after Muhammad emigrated to Medina and started to put his vision of an ideal society into practice. There were many aspects of his reforms, but I'm just going to stick to two in particular. Those two relate to market practices. The first is that Muhammad started a market in Medina. And when he started a market, he announced to his community, this is your market, and then he added something which was really key, and let there be no tax on it. So he started a market. That's not unusual, but he started one that was tax-free. So here you have something that's economic policy, that's fiscal competition. He's inducing trade and attracting trade to his particular market through fiscal incentives. And there's a second step that is critical, and that is even more, that's of seminal importance in the history of economic thinking. This occurred at a time when there was a famine in Medina, and as was customary at the time, people would expect authorities to fix prices for food necessities. I should say that it was customary at the time in markets all over the Middle East for people in charge of communities to fix prices for daily necessities. But Mohammed, on this occasion, when people appealed to him and said, look, our budgets are being squeezed because food prices are going up, on this occasion, he didn't do what his adherents hoped he would do. He didn't set prices. On the contrary, he said, prices are in the hand of God. Fixing a price was something which he specifically excluded from his remit as leader of the community. This was, in my opinion, one of the seminal statements in the history of economic thought. I mentioned earlier that Adam Smith said, markets are managed or are guided by an invisible hand. Well, Mohammed said that in Medina at the time, much earlier, and introduced this not as a theoretical concept, but as a practical policy guideline. So these two steps alone, and there was a whole raft of others, of other steps, led to the creation of a capitalist market. Why do I call that a capitalist market? I just want to reiterate that. A society that where governments do not intervene in entrepreneurs who engage in market practices. Now, Mohammed died, and one of the things Hayek said that you can find, that he predicted, that you can find in a society that's capitalist, is a spirit of exploration and initiative and entrepreneurial innovation. This is what we see in early Islamic society, because early Islamic society had a number of innovations that were completely new. Some of those began already in the lifetime of Muhammad. Some of those happened later. The first one that I would like to mention, I'm just going to mention three. The first one is the Waqf, the Islamic charity. It was Muhammad who created a new concept of providing public welfare. The Waqf is an institution is an institution that provides public welfare, and it has its own endowment. The first time a Waqf was created was a few years before Muhammad passed away, and he set up the first Waqf in cooperation with the later Caliph Umar. So Muhammad and Umar were the first people involved in setting up the first Waqf. Setting up a charity in itself is not an innovation. Charities have existed since humankind banded together in societies. But Waqfs are different because Waqfs are their own legal entities, which are ring-fenced from interference by external sources. So a Waqf was a seminal financial innovation. That one occurred while Muhammad was still alive. The second one happened long after he had died. That was monetary reform. One of the things Hayek says you can tell how you can tell a capitalist society is that they care about stable money and money that has value. You find in Islamic society that within 60 years, just over 60 years of Muhammad's death, they created gold coinage and silver coinage, the dinars and the dirham. These were created in the reign of the Caliph Abdul Malik. When Abdul Malik created a gold currency in Islam, that was very innovative because it was the first time that a gold currency was created outside Europe. And he did this in currency competition with the then prevailing gold currency of Byzantium. So monetary reform is the second innovation of early Islam. Then there's a third innovation, the funduk. Funduk is a term one encounters if one travels in an Arabic country because it's used for hotel or hostel. But in early Islam, funduks also had another purpose. Funduks were walled structures where people from abroad could bring their goods, store them, and sell them. And these funduks were set up and managed by expatriates, principally from Italian cities such as Venice and Genoa. So from very early on in Islamic history, you had expatriate merchants community who had their own tax privileges, who had their own legal protection by local domestic authorities, who traded and who brought goods into the Islamic Empire and brought goods from the Islamic Empire back to Europe. And the funduk very much functions exactly the way an offshore trade center does. It was outside. It had legal protection by domestic authorities, but it had its own, and it's had its own privileges, but it created business and created scope for entrepreneurial initiative. So I've given you three, these have been three examples of early Islamic innovations. The waqf as a means to provide public welfare through private initiative. Monetary reform, creation of a gold currency to create stable money. And thirdly, offshore trade centers, the funduk, which benefited cross international trade and promoted international trade. I now come to capitalism in Europe. You might ask, well, capitalism is something that exists all over the world. How did it get out of Arabia? How did it get out of the Islamic Empire? Did people just invent their own capitalism then later? My argument is, no, they didn't. All the business people from Venice and Genoa who traded in funduks were very alert to what they saw around them. And when they went home, they said, when we get home, we're going to try some of this. So the promotion of Mediterranean seafaring by way of convoys, which sailed out from Venice and Genoa, copied the financing structures of caravans. You needed people to underwrite them. You needed them to be supplied with goods by a certain date. They needed protection and they needed to travel in groups. So they did everything pretty much the way a caravan did, only they did it across the sea rather than across the desert. Now you might say, well, hang on, they probably figured that out on their own, didn't they? Well, maybe they did. But if they did, why did convoys originate in precisely those cities who had trade in the Islamic Empire? If the idea offered itself equally to everyone, you would have seen convoys in France or in Spain or in England or in Germany. But you don't. You see them in the very places where Europeans were interfacing with the Islamic Empire. There's another aspect of capitalist society. I mentioned earlier, Hayek said capitalist societies innovate in many areas. Another such area is, for example, provision of welfare. And we find that in England, the Inns of Court and the earliest colleges were set up as trusts. Now, Inns of Court and colleges copy the structure of madrasas. Madrasas were establishments of higher learning in Islamic countries, usually funded by waqfs. Now, the odd thing is that colleges and inns of courts were set up by the very people who had contact with the Islamic Empire, because they had a base in Jerusalem, the Knights Templar and the Franciscan friars. If trusts had been something that Europeans figured out for themselves, how come they happened in the very places and through the very people who were interfacing with their counterparts in the Islamic Empire? It seems an odd coincidence. And there is the third issue, the creation of a gold currency in Western Europe. The first gold coins were minted in Sicily, in Genoa, and in Venice, and in Florence. These are the very cities that had, the very cities that interfaced with the Islamic Empire. If a gold currency were something that Europeans had thought of themselves, why did it happen there and not someplace else? So in closing, what I'd say is capitalism, which began in Arabia, then came to Europe, but it wasn't a self-starter in Europe. It was something that came through emulating examples set by Islam. So in sum, I've got three takeaways. The first is that capitalism started in Islam. It's the first instance that you have a capitalist society, because it was started by a prophet who, amongst several other innovations, said prices are in the hand of God. The second takeaway is that in a capitalist society, you see continuing innovation. And you see that in early Islamic society. And I gave you a couple of examples, the waqf, monetary reform, and the funduk. And the third is that capitalism happened in Europe, in precisely those places where Europeans interacted with Muslims. So it's very difficult to claim that capitalism in Europe started in any way other than through exposure to Islam. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.